wounded with them, including a triumphant, grinning Kendall. Just before dark, a single platoon from Delta Company arrived and took a position between Mellis's and Goodwin's platoons. That evening, while friendly artillery fire plastered Matterhorn and Daniels laid down protective fire that surrounded Bravo Company and the Delta Company platoon like smoky armor, the kids drank Kool-Aid and Pillsbury funny faces and ate sea rations, happily throwing occasional dirt claws at one another. As far as they were concerned, it was fucking over. For General Neitzel, however, it wasn't over, and time was running out. He radioed Colonel Mulvaney at VCB, urging him to move even faster. Mulvaney, however, knew that the window of opportunity was closing. The NVA command must have recognized its vulnerability by now, and the Gook regiment was probably heading for Laos as fast as it could go. Neitzel's prayer that the weather would remain bad and give him one extra day hadn't been answered. The fog had lifted too soon, Mulvaney chuckled. Too many of those goddamn kids in Bravo Company had been praying against Neitzel, he thought proudly. No, the NVA would see the advantage gone and scatter to regroup in Laos, as always. The NVA could wait for years if they had to. It had been chancy all along. Risk, the general had said, hoping Bravo would slow things up enough to get the entire 24th Regiment engaged. It would have been a hell of a fight. But with the choppers grounded, the Marines just couldn't move fast enough. The NVA were putting a rear guard on Matterhorn to keep the high ground as they pulled back, but otherwise the northern part of the operation was over. With their northern flank exposed, the two units moving down the Da Krong and Aw Shao valleys to the south would also be called back. No need to push when time was on your side, Mulvaney mused. That was the problem. The NVA had forever. The Americans had until the next election. Still, it had cost only half a company of Marines to fuck up a major thrust. Since the entire division had been involved, all the casualties and deaths in Bravo Company would be compared with a full division, and the daily briefing would simply say, light casualties. The action wouldn't even get into the newspapers. Thwarting a major enemy offensive before it got going just wasn't news. Reporters cared about hot stories and Pulitzers, neither of which resulted from battles that involved only light casualties. Heavy casualties made hot stories and supported anti-military politics. Over time, continual bad news will discourage any civilian population, and Americans had the lowest tolerance on the planet for bad news. Mulvaney grunted. He had to hand it to the Gooks. They have us coming and going, he thought. He left for evening chow, knowing there would be a lot of backpedaling in the morning. Neitzel had his dick hanging out all over Quang Tri province and not a goddamn thing to show for it. Mulvaney chuckled again. He'd probably have to do some quick backpedaling himself. In Lieutenant Colonel Simpson's tent, no one wanted to chuckle. Both Simpson and Blakely felt the opportunity trickling away like sand trickling through their fingers. Hawk was right, Simpson growled. The place to be is in the fucking bush, not sitting on our cans moving goddamned artillery around. Hawk was right to go up there. I think he ought to be reprimanded for abandoning his duty station, if not fucking court-martialed, Blakely said quietly but firmly. You're just an old woman, Blakely, Simpson said. He poured himself another bourbon and tossed it down quickly. I see we move the CP to Helicopter Hill. Direct the operation from right smack in the middle. Blakely immediately thought how that might look to an awards review board. He dismissed the idea as foolish, then thought about it again. He knew, even if the old buzzard didn't, that the show was just about over. With a high chance of fixed-wing air, escape to the DMZ blocked, two battalions of Marines moving in from the south and east, and a reinforced company sitting right smack on the NVA's line of supply, Nguyen would be heading back to Laos. The Gooks weren't idiots, at least not the North Gooks, but they probably would defend Matterhorn to cover their withdrawal. Some value might be squeezed out of that. Maybe you've got a point, sir, Blakely said. Goddamn right I do, Simpson said, pouring himself another bourbon. He offered the bottle to Blakely. Blakely was looking at his empty glass, not at the bottle, and thinking quickly. He began talking, still staring at the glass. "Given the casualties from Bravo Company," he said carefully, preparing his case, "the poor kill ratio, falling asleep on the job, the list goes on, it would look almost imperative that a good battalion commander personally take control of a leadership situation as badly out of hand as that." Simpson looked at Blakely, still holding the bottle of bourbon out to him. Then he slowly withdrew it. Blakely let him think. "Major Blakely," Simpson said after a long silence, "I want the CP group ready to move to Bravo Company's position tonight."
"Tonight, sir?"
"You heard me. Tonight. Get Stevens to gin up a bunch of Arty Illumination and tell Bainford we'll only need one chopper." He touched the top of the bottle as if it were a talisman. "And I want an assault prepared for Matterhorn first thing in the morning."
"By who, sir?"
"By Bravo Company. They need to redeem their honor and get their pride back."
The battalion CP group arrived on the hill around 2200. They immediately occupied Fitch's bunker, moving Fitch and his CP group into an open hole near the LZ. Around 2300, Mellis led a reconnaissance. He moved the squad slowly and silently until he felt he was close to the enemy positions. He called in an illumination round. In the swaying greenish light, he saw the line of abandoned holes that the enemy had dug all around Helicopter Hill. The NVA had probably withdrawn to the bunkers on Matterhorn as soon as the weather cleared, knowing the jets would be coming. Mellis was back by 0100. "They fucking DD'd and we'll be out of here tomorrow," he told Fitch and Goodwin. Goodwin grinned. Fitch, however, was tight-lipped. He just crawled back from his former bunker, now occupied by Simpson and Blakely.
"What's the matter?"
Mellis asked when he noticed Fitch's mood.
"Those cocksuckers didn't relieve you, did they?"
He was suddenly afraid his friend would be leaving.
"Hawk told me about the packs."
Fitch shook his head. "Nothing so good as that." Goodwin and Mellis looked at each other, puzzled. Then Fitch said in despair, "We've been ordered to take Matterhorn. Daylight assault at first light." Mellis, fearful, took a breath.
"We can't take these guys up there again,"
he whispered. Goodwin stood up, outlined against the faint light of the night sky. He was looking in the direction of Matterhorn, even though it could not be seen. "The colonel says we've lost our pride, getting kicked off that hill," Fitch said. "And now we're going to get it back." He was trembling again.
"He's insane," Mellis said. "We're still way under strength, even counting the new guys."
Fitch tried to think of something to say to his two lieutenants. "We're supposed to get fixed wing." Mellis and Goodwin just stared at him. He tried again.
"Maybe it's not so insane. I mean, to keep the initiative, someone has to move into an attack position in the dark. The rest of Delta isn't here yet, so it's up to us." "Fuck that shit, Fitch," Mellis said. "The only reason they can't wait a day is because they're afraid the fucking gooks will leave."
He filled his lungs with damp, cool air and then let it out, trying to control his temper.
"Fuck 'em and their goddamn body counts. I've counted enough fucking bodies."
Goodwin backed Mellis up.
"These guys have come through too much shit to be killed by a fucking madman."
He rubbed his hands on his bloody trousers. He'd been hit that morning, but had said nothing.
"Listen," he added, "this is no joke. I know I like to joke around, but this is serious."
He paused to make sure Fitch and Mellis understood he wasn't kidding.
"I say we kill the motherfuckers. We wait until the shit starts coming in and then toss in a couple of frags. They can both die fucking heroes. I'll write them up myself."
"I'll help you," Mellis said. Fitch shook his head.
"You know you can't do that, Scar. It's murder."
"Murder," Scar said bitterly. He waved his arm in an arc, indicating the hill and its remains.
"What's the difference?"
Fitch, suddenly overwhelmed, put his face in his hands and bent almost double over the map before him.
"I don't know the difference,"
he muttered. Just don't fucking bother me. His hands were shaking again. After a moment of quiet, Malice said, to no one in particular, "We can blame war on orders, which means we can blame it on someone else. You have to take personal responsibility for murder."
"I don't know what the fuck that means, Malice," Goodwin said.
"I didn't until a few days ago," Malice answered. He thought of Pellini and the dead soldier above his hull, both killed, or murdered, by his hand. Fitch raised his head.
"There's no way around it unless you want to commit mutiny," he said. "I'm not about to do that. When I get out of here, I want to screw my brains out. I don't want to go to jail."
Malice picked at the calluses on his hands. He kicked softly at the mud and sighed. He knew Fitch was right.
"All right," he said. "Let's see what kind of fucked up plan you come up with this time, Jim."
He and Fitch looked at each other and started laughing. Goodwin shook his head and then joined them.
"It ain't gonna be the flying fucking wedge, Jack."
Once again, they worked over the bleak options. By 0300, they had a plan. Goodwin would go up the narrower east side with 2nd Platoon. Mellis, with a platoon made up of the bulk of the replacements and the remnants of 1st Platoon, a squad from 3rd Platoon, and the mortar squad, which was now carrying only rifles, would take on the broader south slope. They'd attack together, the southeast shoulder of the hill shielding them from one another's fire. Conman would take the remaining Marines from Kendall's platoon, now not much larger than a squad, and 6 of the replacements and secure the northern finger. That was to stop the sniper fire they'd taken on the previous assault, and, in particular, the machine gun that had given away its position to shoot at the choppers. The back of Goodwin's assaulting platoon would be exposed to its fire. Cortell would take over Connolly's squad. Fitch and the company CP group would set between Malice's and Goodwin's platoons and advance behind them so that Fitch could at least have a chance of seeing what was going on. Delta Company would fly in to protect the battalion CP group and lay down a base of fire. 3rd Squad of 1st Platoon, now under Hamilton, along with Mole and his A-gunner, would circle around to the west and kill the NVA who ran off the hill, or prevent reinforcements from arriving if the assault bogged down. Mellis made Jacobs his platoon sergeant and gave Jacobs's squad to Robertson, who had been the leader of his first fire team. Then he called all of the squad leaders together and repeated the plan. He felt it would be better to keep the squads intact, even if they were all about half their former size. That, however, gave him and Jacobs 5 squads to control instead of 3. Connolly gulped at being given the responsibility for what remained of 3rd Platoon and taking out the machine gun on the ridgeline. He wished he had been a bad squad leader instead of a good one. He wished Vancouver were still with him to help. He wished he didn't have so many totally green kids. He wished he were back home. Malice noticed his reaction. "Conman, I know you can do it. Otherwise I wouldn't have given it to you." Connolly stopped gulping, but Cortell spoke up after Malice had finished the brief.
"I'm not going," he said. "I won't take over Conman's squad."
Everyone looked at him silently.
"Call me a chicken shit motherfucker, but I ain't going up no hill 'cause some crazy honky out to make general over my black ass. I ain't going, man, and I won't be the only one."
Nobody blamed him. He had been wounded in the head and could have jumped on the bird that brought the battalion CP group in that afternoon, but he had stayed.
"Okay, Cortell," Mellis said.
"Who do you want to take the squad?" Cortell had expected a different reaction. He was taken aback. He looked around. No one spoke.
"Ryder," he finally said.
"Go get him." Cortell hesitated. Then he whirled angrily and headed toward the lines. Mellis felt the fear of those huddled near him in the darkness.
"Anyone else who's got an excuse that'll get him off the hill can take it," Mellis said.
People shuffled their feet, looking at the ground. Jacob spoke up.
"Germain's got an R&R,
and his arm is fucked up from that scrap metal in it.
Please, Jake, Mella said. Before I get killed, just once, call it shrapnel.
The others laughed softly.
You have someone else who can handle the M-79? Mellis asked.
I'll carry it myself,
Jacobs replied.
Okay. Mellis looked around. Anyone else?
No one spoke.
Ryder crawled up to the group, looking worried. His hair was scorched, his eyebrows were burned off, and he had salve all over his face.
Lieutenant, I hear we're going to make the assault tomorrow. Cortell says everyone's going crazy and he's going to get medevaced.
There it is, Ryder, Mellis said. Waiting for the coming assault was different from waiting for the previous ones. It was as if they'd already thrown their lives away.
Mellis kept thinking about girls he wished he'd known better. He remembered a dance thrown by the Boston Rugby Club. He'd gone up to Boston from Princeton with two friends from the rugby team. They both had girlfriends at Radcliffe, one of whom had fixed Mellis up with her roommate. They'd worn tuxedos, the girls' long dresses. It was snowing, soft, gentle snow. After the dance, they'd gone to a house on a lake and curled up before a fire. The other two couples drifted off to bedrooms, leaving Mellis alone with the girl. He could tell that she was afraid he was just another animal from the rugby team. Mellis himself was afraid she'd think he was clumsy because he didn't know what to do. They had sat there, nervous, unable even to talk to each other, and had wasted that precious moment. Mellis wanted to reach out across the Pacific and apologize. He didn't remember her name. She didn't know he was in a hole about to die. War was breaking life apart and splintering it, so there were no second chances, and all the first chances were wasted. Mellis also saw Anne crying. She had turned her back on him their last night together. How could she be the one crying? But now he'd never be able to explain how he felt, explain how it hurt, find out why she did it, apologize for his lack of understanding, or cry out at her for hers. They were torn apart and separate with no second chances. He saw himself rolling down the hill with Pauline. He saw the neat hole in Pauline's head. Then he remembered Bass whittling on his short timer stick, and Vancouver leaning over him and Scar in the empty bunker and saying, "Nagulian went that away." Once, later that night, Mellis whispered,
"You all right?"
He meant Bass, Vancouver, and Pauline. Jackson thought Mellis meant him and answered that he was.
Mellis wondered why Jackson had said that.
The radio whispered with the sound of Goodwin checking an LP, even before an assault. War's tedious tasks went on uninterrupted. The fog hung thick and heavy as the kids formed into a single line on the south side of Helicopter Hill. Mellis felt as if the clouds above him were slabs of slate. The kids were fatigued and filled with despair at the insanity of it all. Yet they were all checking ammunition, sliding bolts back and forth, preparing to participate in the insanity. It was as if the veterans of the company, succumbing to this insanity, had decided to commit suicide.
Mellis, sick with exhaustion, now knew why men threw themselves on hand grenades. He silently inspected his platoon. Many of the kids were strangers to him, but others were familiar friends. He'd pull on someone's loose canteen, tug a hand grenade that was carelessly placed, going through the routine of inspection as a mother tidies her children before they leave for school. Mellis heard someone trudging down the hillside toward them. A ghostly figure came out of the dark fog, an M-16 on his shoulder, full bandoliers of magazines across his flak jacket.
"Well, Mel," Hawk said, "where's my fucking platoon?"
Mellis could only shake his head. Words failed him. Finally, he said, "You take third herd, Hawk, with con man. It's not much more than a squad. The idea is to hold down the sniper fire on Scar's rear from that northeast finger. There's a machine gun there."
He pulled out his map and the flashlight with the red lens.
I think it's right here, he said, pointing at the place he'd calculated.
You'll probably have to clear some bunkers. He looked up at Hawk's intense dark eyes.
Thanks for coming, Jayhawk. I hope you don't get fucking killed.
Why do you think I'm taking the platoon that's not going up the fucking hill? Hawk turned and walked down the line of men, holding up his fingers in the Hawk power sign.
Hey, Lieutenant Jayhawk! You're gonna get your ass shot off, someone called. Only if the fucking gooks have invented a bullet that shoots underground.
Hawk had the kids laughing at death. Palak's voice came over the PRC-25s.
Okay, Bravo 1, 2, and 3, kickoff time.
The company walked off into the black jungle as the artillery shrieked above them and exploded into Matterhorns, shaking the ground. The light from the exploding shells was reflected and softened by the fog and came to their eyes as pale glimmers. They passed Cortell and Germain, Jacobs's M-79 man, sitting on a log watching them.
Good luck, you guys,
Cortell said sincerely. Jacobs said thanks, so did a few others. Nobody thought badly of them. Germain watched his friends file by, silently shaking his head, as if telling himself,
I won't go.
Not this time. This time, it's crazy.
Germain and Cortell watched the last man disappear. They said nothing for at least 3 minutes. Then Germain spoke up.
I feel kind of shitty.
Me too, Cortell said.
There was another silence.
You think we go to heaven when we die?
Germain asked.
I don't think nothing. I believe Jesus take care of us when we die.
Cortell looked at Germain.
Believing's not thinking.
Germain took that in for a while.
What if you're wrong?
Cortell laughed.
What if you wrong? You've been worse off than me all your life. I had the safe bet, not you.
I didn't say I didn't believe.
No, you're just playing it safe and not choosing. Jesus don't want you to play safe. You don't get any place if you don't choose.
I don't want to go nowhere but back to the world.
Yeah, I'll be right there with you,
Cortell said. He was silent for a moment. Then he said,
Everyone here think it easy for me. I be this good little church boy from Mississippi with my good little church-going mammy. And since I be this stupid country nigger with a big faith, I don't have no troubles.
Well, it just don't work that way.
He paused. Germain said nothing.
I see my friend Williams get ate by a tiger,
Cortell continued.
I see my friend Broya get his face ripped off by a mine. What you think I'd do all night, sit around thanking sweet Jesus? Raise my palms to sweet heaven and cry hallelujah? You know what I'd do? You know what I'd do? I'd lose my heart.
Cortell's throat suddenly tightened, strangling his words.
I'd lose my heart.
He took a deep breath, trying to regain his composure. He exhaled and went on quietly, back in control.
I sit there and I don't see any hope. Hope gone.
Cortell was seeing his dead friends.
Then the sky turned gray again in the east, and you know what I do? I choose all over to keep believing. All along. I know Jesus could maybe be just some fairy tale, and I could be just this one big fool. I choose anyway.
He turned away from his inward images and returned to the blackness of the world around him.
It ain't no easy thing.
The platoon was well into the jungle when Mellis saw Germain, holding an M-16, break past him. Germain handed the rifle to Jacobs and took back his M-79 grenade launcher and the vest filled with grenades without saying a word. Jacobs turned around and grinned at Mellis, his face lit by an illumination round. Germain kept moving forward, refusing to turn around.
Hey, Germain,
Mellis finally whispered during a halt. Germaine turned around, looking chagrined.
"Don't look so fucking hangdog," Mellis said gently. "Did Cortell come too?"
"Yeah. Crazy motherfucker started praying and shoved off without asking me if I'd come or not. So I shoved off too. Crazy motherfucker."
"You were him?" Mellis asked. Germaine laughed.
"Fuck if I know, sir."
"Well, I'm glad you guys came. I hope you make your R&R."
"Me too, sir."
They kicked off again. Mellis put Robertson on point with Germaine and three new kids, knowing that Robertson and Germaine had scaled Skycap together and were tight. Between them, they could probably handle the green ones. The newbies were starting at every little sound. The artillery barrage grew louder as they neared Matterhorn. Robertson slowed to one pace at a time, inching toward the edge of the jungle. The entire line waited as Robertson's squad inched forward, feeling for the dangerous open fields of fire that Bravo itself had cleared. Gradually the fog turned gray with the coming of dawn. Then Robertson held up his hand. He turned and whispered something that Mellis couldn't hear through the roar of the artillery. Mellis knew they'd reached the edge of the trees. He scrambled forward in a crouch. Robertson was on his belly, peering out just a meter short of the cleared ground. Before them stood Matterhorn, now ugly and barren, swathed in the sweet sick smoke of the artillery. Mellis could see the large gaps torn in the wire during and after their previous assault. He could also see 1st Platoon's former bunkers. He moved the platoon into a long assault line just inside the jungle and radioed Goodwin to link up. When Goodwin radioed that he had contact with Mellis's right flank, Mellis radioed Fitch. He told Fitch that they were at the final line of departure. The kids lay on the ground, rifles in front of them, sweating, some taking nervous sips of water and Kool-Aid from their canteens. The artillery stopped. They heard the rest of Delta Company coming in on choppers, which were met with only desultory rifle fire. Still, Mellis felt frightened. He watched the hill anxiously. The artillery had been useless against the fortified positions. Nice work on those bunkers, he thought ruefully. Now it all depended on whether or not fixed wing could take them out with napalm and 250-pound or maybe even 500-pound bombs. They waited. Nothing happened. Mellis's fear overcame him, and he reached for the hook.
Bravo 6. This is Bravo 5. Where's the fucking fixed wing with the snake and nape? Over. It's supposed to be on its way. They're having trouble with the weather. Can't see the fucking hill and going too fast to risk coming in lower.
Fuck,
Jackson whispered. Mellis radioed Hamilton, who had continued westward to position his squad to stop any NVA reinforcements or to kill any NVA retreating from Matterhorn. The going was terribly slow.
Get your asses moving,
Mellis said fiercely.
Hamilton rogered.
Mellis lay in close to Jacobs and Jackson.
They waited.
Mellis wanted to shit again. His bowels felt like they were full of wet tissue paper. Jackson felt the radio pressing his chest into the earth. This made it uncomfortable to breathe, but at the same time he felt good to be pressed so close to the ground. A strange insect walked in front of his nose. It occurred to Jackson that in the insect's world, the events of the day would go unnoticed. His mind flipped back to the world, to his family, to his neighborhood in Cleveland, bringing lunch to his dad at Moe's Tire and Retread, his mother laughing with the customers as she styled their hair at Billy's Cut and Perm. Like the insect, they too lived in a separate world. Mellis checked on Hamilton again. He was still several hundred meters from his destination. This irritated Mellis, and he let Hamilton know it. He checked in with Fitch.
God damn it, where's our fucking airplanes? I don't know, Five, out,
Fitch said curtly. Mellis crawled backward. Jackson followed him. They moved in a slow crouch behind the long line of Marines.
We're waiting for Snake and Nape,
Mellis would say, touching kids on their shoulders. We're waiting for the fixed wing. They're going to napalm the shit out of the hill with snake-eye bombs. The kids grew less jittery. He and Jackson reached Cortell. Cortell looked up at Mellis.
I'm crazy, Lieutenant. I'm a crazy cotton-picking idiot.
I think so, too, Ryder said, grinning.
Hey, man, Cortell replied. I do the thinking around here. I think you being squad leader went to your head.
Ryder smiled and shrugged his shoulders. Jackson knelt beside Cortell, and the two of them touched fists in the hand dance, looking at each other solemnly.
Hey, brother, we in a real nightmare, Jackson finally said.
You just trust in Jesus,
Cortell said. They both knew these might be the last words they would exchange.
But keep your fucking rifle out of the mud, too.
They touched hands again, and Jackson turned to follow Mellis down the line. Mellis and Jackson returned to their original spot next to Jacob's. The hill was deadly quiet. No air stirred. The thinning artillery smoke tinted the blasted mud gray. Jacobs opened a packet of choo-choo cherry, poured the dark red crystals into his hand, and popped them into his mouth. His hand ran red where the sweat on his palm dissolved the crystals. He handed the package to Jackson, who also took some. Jackson's lips turned reddish-purple. The radio hissed.
Foxtrot whiskey coming in. Get your fucking heads down. Over.
The word passed along the line. Then a rushing scream filled their ears, and the huge bulk of a phantom fighter bomber slashed so closely above their heads that they felt the wake turbulence. It disappeared across the top of the hill. As this sound died away, it was replaced by the chatter of a lone automatic weapon.
How come they didn't drop nothing?
Jake asked. He had taken out his Instamatic camera. Mellis shrugged. A second jet came in above them. Snake-eye bombs, four tiny eggs, dark against the gray sky, popped out of its belly. The bombs suddenly blossomed four-petaled tails that arrested their rapid movement, allowing the jet to roar safely out of danger before they hit. The bombs exploded harmlessly on the other side of the hill. Mellis was on the radio instantly.
Those stupid motherfuckers are bombing the wrong place. Tell them to drop 500. Over. I hear you, Bravo 5, Fitch replied. We're telling. Out.
Another phantom thundered overhead. Mellis watched in disbelief as four more snake eyes floated harmlessly out of sight.
God damn it, Skipper, they're missing the fucking hill, Mellis shouted.
Goodwin was on the radio, too.
Please, for God's sake, please tell them they're hitting the wrong target. If they don't hit those bunkers, we're going to get creamed. Over.
Mellis sank back into the ground. Again the jets passed overhead with a shattering noise. Again they wasted their precious cargo on the jungle. Jake turned around and looked at Mellis, his eyes wild with frustration and fear.
What the fuck can I do?
Mellis nearly shouted at him. Fitch was pleading with Captain Bainford's radio operator. Bainford eventually came up on the hook.
I tell you, one of the pilots reported a secondary. Over. I don't care if you reported hitting the Glorious Revolution ammunition factory. You're missing the fucking target. Over. Look, Bravo 6, you have to try and see things from their perspective. They're going 500 miles an hour, and it's foggy. It's a hell of a job. Over. You get them on fucking target or I'll open up on them, so help me God. Over. We'll see what we can do. Big John 1-4 out.
A single jet came in, only a few hundred feet above them. Two long, sausage-shaped cylinders tumbled out. These were the napalm. The cylinders fell out of sight, moving at 500 miles an hour across the top of the hill, uselessly searing the jungle with the flaming jellied chemical. A second jet followed. One of its canisters caught the top of the hill just inside the circle of bunkers. Orange flame mixed with intense black smoke washed across the dark earth of Matterhorn's LZ. But there was nothing to burn there. Mellis grabbed the hook. He switched off the company frequency. He came up on the battalion frequency and started shouting,
God
damn it, you tell those stupid motherfuckers to drop 200 meters. I say again, drop 200 meters.
Bravo 5, this is Big John 3. You clear the fucking nets. We're controlling the fixed wing. They said the last drop looked right on. Now get off the net. That's an order.
God damn it, I tell you, they can't fucking see. I'm right here. They're hitting the wrong fucking target.
Mellis rolled over and moaned. The two planes came in again, and again the napalm sprayed uselessly several hundred meters to the northwest of the hill. Then, they didn't come in anymore. Fitch's crisp voice came in over the company net. That's it. The weather's closed them out. We had another flight on station, but Big John says they won't be able to run them. It's too dangerous in this weather. There was a pause. Too dangerous, Mellis said to no one. Fitch came up again.
Okay. That's it. No more air. Show's over. Let's go. Over.
Bravo 1, Roger, Mellis said, handing the receiver to Jackson. Goodwin rogered, and so did Hawk. And then Mellis stood up. His hands were shaking. The blood pounded so hard in his throat that each heartbeat hurt. His thighs felt too weak to keep his knees from folding. His empty inside still churned with the desire to eliminate watery feces. He gave the signal and walked forward into the nakedness of the hillside. The others walked with him, emerging from the trees in a single, quavery line. Chapter 18. The long line of Marines moved forward in silence, breaking and bending on the blasted ground, wavering around shattered stumps, forming up again. Their breathing became labored as they climbed the steep slope.
Keep walking, Mellis was saying to himself. Don't run. Keep walking.
20 meters. He glanced over his shoulder to see if there were any stragglers. The jungle behind the Marines already looked, as usual, impenetrable. 25 meters. A kid stumbled momentarily, pitching forward. He caught himself. The line moved upward. 28 meters. Maybe no one was up there. 30 meters. Only the sound of breathing could be heard as they walked up the hill. The bunkers seemed miles above them. Mellis slipped backward on the slope but caught himself. He was still thinking. Keep walking. Don't panic. Maybe no one's there. Don't run. Keep it all until you need it. Maybe no one's there. The tension was like a balloon being filled to its bursting point. With every step, more air was forced in. Until the agonized rubber burst. The bunkers winked light, and the ground around the Marines seemed to come alive. The air was split by bullets and the sound of AK-47s, SKS rifles, and Russian-built RPD 7.62 machine guns. Almost immediately, Fitch gave the signal for Delta Company on Helicopter Hill to open up. There was a mind-numbing roar as Delta poured bullets above the heads of the advancing Marines of Bravo Company. Mellis heard the bullets cracking and snapping over his head and watched them hit all along the line of bunkers. Adrenaline surged through him. Then he became aware of the cries of those who were being hit. Mellis tried to shout above the roar, "Let's go, goddammit, let's go!" He churned forward, Jackson scrambling to his left. A rush of machine gun bullets hit the mud in front of them, and they both dived for the earth and clawed their way to a log. Out of the corner of his eye, Mellis saw Robertson dive for cover in a shell crater. One of Robertson's squad members, however, was left kicking on the earth behind him. Another Marine grabbed the kid's legs and started to pull him to safety, but the advancing machine gun bullets cut the second kid down. He curled over in a fetal position, holding his abdomen. Then he lay still. Mellis raised his head above the log to start forward. Bullets kicked mud and rock fragments into his face and cracked and snapped over his head. Mellis pushed his face into the ground. It was suicidal to go farther. The attack, barely started, came to a complete halt. Another of the new kids from Robertson's squad darted from cover and tried to reach the two others lying in front of him. He was shot through the chest. Jacobs raced out after him, and Mellis yelled for a corpsman. Doc Fredrickson came running across an open space and dived behind the shelter of the log, while Jacobs brought the kid back in behind it. The entire sequence took approximately 5 seconds. The kid Jacobs had pulled in was dead. There were now four of them and a body huddled behind the log. Mellis was mumbling and praying aloud, although no one could hear him. His face was pressed into the ground. Why, God, why didn't they drop the napalm? Why didn't they hold off until the weather cleared and just burn the fucking hill down? Why are we doing this now? Why doesn't somebody move? The air was alive with noise, bullets, and madness. They had now lain behind the log for more than 30 seconds. Germaine came running across to the group behind the log. Bullets ripped past him. "There's no fucking room for you, Germaine!" Mellis shouted, but Germaine ignored him and kept coming. Germaine piled on top of Mellis and Jackson, knocking the air from Mellis's lungs. He made it, Mellis thought. Germaine's chest was heaving and his eyes were darting back and forth wildly, but he had made it without being hit. That thought kept picking at Mellis's mind. Mellis started to turn his own face toward the earth again, trying to ignore the firing and letting the noise and confusion immobilize him, but Germaine shouted,
"I know where the fucking gun is, Lieutenant!"
Mellis wanted to shout back at him, "So fucking what? I'm not going up there. I'm not going up there so some fucking colonel can get a fucking medal." Instead, he said, "We'll shoot at the motherfucker," and pressed his face down into the wonderful earth. Germaine rolled off Mellis's and Jackson's backs to the end of the log. He fired a grenade, then ducked down again as the earth in front of the log and several hundred meters behind it exploded with machine gun bullets. Fitch was shouting over the radio. Germaine popped up and fired a second round, and then a third. Mellis couldn't hear above the noise what Fitch was saying. He covered one ear. Fitch's voice said, "What the fuck's going on over there? Two is pinned down. They can't move. Three's run into at least five positions on the finger. The whole front of the goddamn hill is laced with fucking machine guns. What the fuck's happening over there? Over!" Mellis was panting. He didn't know how to answer. He heard a sharp cry and turned around. Germaine, shot through the shoulder, reeled and fell on top of Jackson, blood running from beneath his flak jacket. Jackson shoved him off and the blood spattered on Mellis. Fredrickson reached across and stuffed a wad of battle dressing into the exit hole in Germaine's back while Jacobs grabbed the M79 and, enraged, started to fire at the machine gun Germaine had taken on. Mellis looked at the blood on his arms and hand and at Germaine's contorted face. Suddenly he seemed to be floating above the scene, watching the entire company. Everything was in slow motion and fuzzily quiet. Germaine was probably going to die. An explosion from Goodwin's area rocked the hill. They'd now been behind the log slightly more than a minute. Mellis floated high above the hill. He saw the line of Marines stretched out below him, some kicking or contorted in pain, some lying still. He saw the people he knew, still alive, trying to stay alive, behind logs, in small defilades, many lying flat on the ground and attempting to merge with the earth. He studied the bunkers. He saw the interlocking fire as if in a drawing. He saw the machine gun Germaine had attacked. And he knew. He floated back to a tactics class at the basic school where a red-headed major said that junior officers were mostly redundant because the corporals and sergeants could take care of just about anything. But there would come a time when the junior officers would earn every penny of their pay, and they would know when that time came. Mellis came back to the hill. His time had come. He saw the smoke from the burning napalm. He saw what would open the door through the interlocking fire, and it was right in front of him, shooting at him. Mellis keyed the handset. "Bravo 6, this is Bravo 5, over." As if from behind his own shoulder, Mellis watched himself telling Fitch the situation calmly over the radio. He seemed to be reading lines. He was no longer there, but somehow directing the scene from above or beside it. Mellis didn't wait for an answer. He handed the receiver to Jackson.
Why, Germaine?
Why the one who volunteered while the shitbirds stayed in the rear? Why were his friends dying? There seemed only one way out of the nightmare. The single machine gun was the way.
Gun up! Mellis yelled. Get a fucking gun up here!
Somehow he had to draw the machine gun's fire. A new kid ran forward with an M60. An ammo humper scrambled after him with the heavy steel boxes of ammunition belts. The gunner's eyes were wild with fear and pain. He had been shot in the left calf. Mellis could see flecks of blood coming off his soaked trouser leg. Still, he came lurching forward, running hard. He lunged in on top of Fredrickson, then rolled over just as the ammo humper piled on top of them. His eyes were very white against his black face. It occurred to Mellis that if this kid weren't here, he would probably be hot-dogging on his high school's basketball court.
You start shooting that fucking bunker. That one right there, Mellis shouted, pointing straight ahead. Don't let up.
The new kid nodded. He moved, leaving blood behind. Mellis could see it spurting rhythmically. An artery, he thought abstractedly. Maybe the kid had 3 or 4 more minutes of consciousness. The kid leaned the M60 over the log, cradling it against his shoulder. The machine gun barked. Then it settled into the disciplined, barrel-saving short bursts of the trained gunner. Mellis felt relief. He silently thanked some instructor at Camp Pendleton. The NVA gunner answered. The duel grew in intensity. The roar increased. The two new kids just kept firing, eyes squinted almost shut, as if squinting could protect them from the bullets. Mellis redirected Jake's M79 fire to a second bunker just to the left of the NVA machine gun. He intended to use the projectiles to blind the people inside with smoke and mud. You keep firing at the fucking entrance, no place else, no matter what I do, he said. Jacobs nodded and loaded another projectile. Mellis pulled a grenade from his suspenders and whispered,
Dear God, help me now.
He felt that this was possibly his last moment of life, here behind this log with these comrades, and knew it was indescribably sweet. A longing sadness arose with the fear, and he looked one more time at his comrades' intent faces. He wet his lips and said goodbye, silently, not wanting to leave the safety of the log and their warm bodies. Then he stood up and ran. He ran as he'd never run before, with neither hope nor despair. He ran because the world was divided into opposites, and his side had already been chosen for him, his only choice being whether or not to play his part with heart and courage. He ran because fate had placed him in a position of responsibility, and he had accepted the burden. He ran because his self-respect required it. He ran because he loved his friends, and this was the only thing he could do to end the madness that was killing and maiming them. He ran directly at the bunker where the grenades from Jake's M79 were exploding. The bullets from the M60 machine gun slammed through the air to his right, slashing past him, whining like tortured cats, cracking like the bullwhip of death. He ran, having never felt so alone and frightened in his life. He passed the large gap in the barbed wire and kept going. The bunker was only 50 meters above him now. He kept waiting for the bullet that would end the run and would let him rest. He almost wanted that bullet so he wouldn't have to continue with the awful responsibility of living, but he ran. He zigzagged. He twisted. His breath came in painful gasps. He saw a shallow hole just above the bunker, and to its right he prayed. He pictured himself striving for it, saw himself from above, small and puny on the vast, terrible hillside, his legs turning. The hole loomed large above him. He hit the hole and rolled, catching a glimpse of movement from the corner of his eye. He twisted around, bringing his M16 to bear at the same time, and was on the point of pulling the trigger, knowing he was doomed. Then the movement solidified into a person wearing a bloody head bandage. It was Cortell. With 3 new kids. They had followed him. Mellis came to his feet, releasing the spoon on the grenade he'd been carrying. He rushed toward the door of the bunker, praying that Jacobs would have the sense to stop firing as he closed in on it. Melis reached the door and ran past the bunker, throwing the grenade inside. He rolled to the right as Cortell came running after him, dropping in a grenade of his own. The two grenades went off almost simultaneously. Melis rolled to his feet. He looked behind him in bewilderment. And then with joy, Jackson was running toward him. Behind Jackson was another fire team. To their right, another group was charging the machine gun bunker while it still received the new gunner's disciplined fire. The whole platoon was swarming up the hill after him. Far off on the right flank of the assault, Melis saw a second platoon scrambling to keep up, Goodwin running in front, waving them forward. Melis's heart surged with wonder. Bullets were now flying uphill from the Marines and downhill from the NVA. They were so thick that at one point Melis heard two bullets collide and then ricochet with a singing buzz parallel to the crossing fire. The air was filled with roaring and screaming. Then farther down the slope, Melis saw, looking like rag dolls, those who hadn't survived or wouldn't survive. Some twitched fitfully. Two were crawling toward the defilade. The others lay still in awkward positions. 3 minutes had passed since the opening shot. From Helicopter Hill, it looked like a textbook assault. In fact, it was. Blakely was pacing up and down in excitement. Simpson, his eyes pressed to his binoculars, was clenching his jaw so tightly that his neck muscles stood out in cords. Melis was running hard to his right, shouting as he went, trying to get his platoon to move toward Goodwin's. The fight had disintegrated into the mad actions of individuals. Noise, smoke, confusion, and fear prevailed. Melis rounded a slight knob and saw Goodwin about 100 meters away, running parallel to the hill, with the radio receiver in his hand, his radio operator scrambling after him to keep the cord slack. Jackson handed Melis the receiver.
"Iskar, sir."
Melis could barely make out what Goodwin was saying because of the noise and Goodwin's wild panting.
"There's a gun. Edge of the LZ, fucking us up good, Jack."
There was more machine gun fire. Melis saw Goodwin go down and then get up.
"Gotta get the motherfucker! With grenades!" Goodwin shouted. "Don't move toward it!"
Just as Goodwin was speaking, Melis saw Robertson pop up from a shell hole and disappear across the lip of the LZ. He was amazed to see Robertson so high above the rest of them. Goodwin was moving upward beneath the lip of the LZ with 5 others, carrying 2 grenades each. They couldn't see Robertson. They had no idea he was there. Melis reached for the receiver. Just as he started to shout, "God damn it, Scar, I've got a man up there," Goodwin sprinted forward, away from his radio. The 5 Marines followed in a rush. Robertson popped up, running across the LZ toward the same bunker Goodwin's group was after, in full view of everyone except them. Robertson reached the bunker's top just as 12 hand grenades came sailing over the lip of the hill. He tried to stop short, his arms flailing in the air. He threw his own grenade away and tried to sprint to safety. The grenades began going off in a sustained explosion, obscuring him. Melis, still holding the handset, shut his eyes. The smoke cleared slightly. The machine gun opened up again. Melis heard Goodwin cursing over the radio. Then Robertson appeared again. All alone inside the ring of enemy fighting holes, exposed, he ran back to the machine gun bunker. He dropped in 2 grenades, then stood calmly taking a 3rd from his suspenders. He pulled the pin and tossed it in. Just then, fire and smoke erupted from the bunker beneath him. He sank to his knees, twisting slightly, and fell out of sight. Melis knew he was dead. "Robertson got the bunker, Scar. I watched it go up," he radioed. Goodwin immediately started moving his platoon forward. Then, from Helicopter Hill, Melis became aware of a faint sound of cheering. The cheering filled Melis with white-hot rage. He turned to look behind him. Marines were firing at bunkers, trying to maneuver up on them from the sides. The North Vietnamese were obviously finished, but still kept firing at the Marines from holes on the lip of the LZ. Melis's fury gave him the cunning of an animal. He forgot everything that had happened before this moment. He knew only that he wanted to kill. He didn't care who or what he killed.
He shouted at Hamilton over the radio. God damn it, get fucking moving. These bastards are gonna start running off this hill and I fucking want them. Move, move, move. I want these fucking gooks killed. You hear me? Over.
Aye, aye, sir. Hamilton's voice crackled back. Hamilton was gasping for breath.
Mellis headed for the open holes above the covered bunkers. He knew that now the work would be dirty and methodical. There would be no more cheering. It occurred to him how much the NVA must hate them not to get up and run. Jacobs joined Mellis and Jackson. His face was streaked with black powder, mud, and sweat. His Instamatic dangled against his flak jacket. Mellis was directing fire teams and individuals watching as position after position was destroyed. He moved cautiously in quick rushes with long waits in between. Jackson and Jacobs followed his every move. Suddenly a man rose from a hole above them and threw a grenade. Mellis was transfixed by the sight. The small, black object seemed to hang suspended in the air above him.
"Grenade! Chi-com!" Jackson yelled.
Mellis saw the grenade explode. Two small objects hurtled past his head, one on each side. Then the world went black as the explosion enveloped him. It slammed him backward, nearly pulling his head from his neck. He sank to the ground, giving into the blackness. The sounds of the firing and confusion whirled away from him. Dying was a huge relief. For the first time, he felt safe. Jackson crawled forward to reach Mellis and called for Doc Fredrickson. Mellis's face was covered with blood, powder burns, and bits of solder. Jackson shouted again, but Fredrickson was out of hearing, moving among the bodies left behind in the initial wild run up the hillside. Jackson started shaking Mellis.
"Sir, sir, you okay?"
He kept looking around for help. The radio was yammering in his ear, but now he or Jacobs, not Mellis, had to make the decisions. Jacobs crawled up to Jackson.
"Jesus, is he all right?"
Jackson was still shaking Mellis and saying, "Sir, sir." He turned to Jacobs.
"I don't know. I think he's dead. Fuck."
Jacobs cursed.
"It's your fucking platoon now, Jake. What we gonna do?"
Jacobs had no idea. A burst of rifle fire sent bullets snapping above his head. He saw Fredrickson running to another body far below. Then the NVA soldier in the hole above them popped up again and threw another grenade.
"Chi-com!"
Jacobs shouted. He and Jackson grabbed Mellis by the legs and tore down the hillside, dragging him face down. As they ran down the hill, the grenade followed them inexorably, moving with gravity as if linked to them. Jackson finally figured it out and shouted, "Stop!" He and Jacobs dug their heels in. They buried themselves against the inert Mellis, and the deadly canister bounced on past them. It exploded about half a second later, just below them. Neither of them was hurt. Jacobs turned Mellis over, face up. He tore open both of Mellis's flak jackets and put an ear to his chest.
"I can't hear, fuck, god damn it!"
Then Jacobs pulled off Mellis's helmet, took his canteen out, and poured grape Kool-Aid all over Mellis's face, washing some of the mess away. He kept shaking the canteen, emptying the remaining drops on Mellis's eyes, which were shut tight with black powder, solder, blood, and dirt. The world again became black for Mellis. He felt the cool stickiness and smelled the sweet grape odor of the Kool-Aid. Then there was the sound of firing and screaming all around him in the darkness. He felt, rather than heard, someone shouting and pulling at his flak jackets and helmet. He tried to move. He couldn't. He tried to open his eyes and finally managed to open one. He saw gray light. The nightmare was continuing. He could not wake up. He wanted to return to oblivion. There were sounds of voices shouting, heard as if underwater. He again came back to the gray light. He knew that he had something to do with or for those voices. He became aware of Jackson lying on top of him, shielding him from fire. He realized that the grenade had been faulty, splitting in two down its soldered seam instead of shattering into deadly pieces.
He became aware that Jacobs was shouting over the radio, lying on his back next to him and Jackson, staring upward at the sky, probably talking with Fitch.
Fuck, Skipper. I think he's Coors. G-grenade, right in the face. No, Corman. What do I do now? Over.
Will you get off me? Mellis said quietly to Jackson. I can't fucking move. Jackson rolled off, tangling the handset cord around Mellis's neck so that the handset was nearly pulled from Jake's hand. This forced Jake to look at Mellis. Jake saw Mellis open one eye.
Jesus fuck, Lieutenant,
he said in relief.
I thought I was going to have to take the platoon.
Thanks, Mellis said. It's nice to know you'd miss me. Mellis's face felt raw, as if there was no skin on it. He couldn't open his right eye. He assumed he'd lost it. He noticed the purple liquid on his hand as he tried to wipe his eyes clean. I told you I hate fucking Bugs Bunny Grape, he said. Jackson was looking up the hill. His eyes opened wide.
Oh, fuck,
he whispered.
Chi-com!
A third grenade came bounding down the hill. Jackson and Jacobs pulled Mellis with them, tripping over each other. They hit the dirt as the grenade exploded. A sudden concussion hit them. There was a puff of dirty smoke, and then the smell. They started to scramble back up toward the hole. Jackson pulled out a grenade and flipped it in a hook shot, arching it over the edge of the lip in front of the hole. It exploded. They waited a moment. Mellis's head finally cleared. Again a deadly black canister came sailing over the lip in reply, and the three of them scrambled for safety. Jacob started parallel to the hill but slipped. He clawed at the steep slope to try to stop his downward momentum. The grenade was sliding down the hill with him. Jacobs cried out in frustration and terror. His fingers raked the muddy clay, his boots churned against the embankment. His eyes grew wide.
I can't fucking stop, he cried.
The grenade went off. Mellis and Jackson both turned their faces to the earth. When they turned around again, half of Jacobs's neck was laid open by the shrapnel. They ran down the hill, grabbed him by his shirt and web belt, and dragged him sideways to a tiny depression in the ground, hoping it would give them shelter. Blood was spurting from Jacobs's throat. He was trying to stop it with his hands. Mellis pushed them aside and put his own hand into the long, narrow hole, feeling the warm throbbing of the blood, the tiny bubbles of air escaping from Jacobs's lungs. Jacobs could make no sound. Only his eyes could express the terror of that last moment. Mellis cried out and shoved his filthy fist hard against the severed carotid artery, trying to stanch the blood. Then the light went from Jacobs's eyes and the terror vanished. Mellis rolled away from him. He looked at Jackson in bewilderment and anguish. Blood dripped from his hand.
Jake?
Jake? He said, questioning, accusing, grieving. Another Chi-Com rolled down the hill. They threw themselves to the ground and the grenade exploded. They were still alive, for no particular reason. Jackson went yelling up the hill, the heavy radio seemingly forgotten on his back. He had a grenade in his right hand and a rifle in the left. Mellis, with sudden clarity, saw the solution. One of them should not duck. He ran to Jackson's left. Jackson hurled a grenade with a moaned curse, then hit the dirt, waiting for it to explode. Mellis did not hit the dirt. He kept running. The grenade went off. Mellis felt invulnerable to it. As the smoke cleared, Mellis threw himself to the ground just at the edge of the lip. A young North Vietnamese soldier pushed his head out of the hole. There was another kid with him, but that one was slumped, inert, against the back wall of the hole. The young NVA soldier pulled another grenade. He cocked his arm back to throw it. Then he saw Mellis's bloodied, blackened face and the rifle pointed squarely at him. Mellis watched the young man's face change from determination to horror to resignation. Still, Mellis did not pull the trigger.
Just don't throw the fucking thing,
he whispered, knowing the young North Vietnamese soldier could not hear or understand him.
Just
Don't throw the fucking thing and I won't shoot. Just give up.
But Mellis saw hatred fill the young man's face. That hatred had kept him in his hole, fighting beyond any possible hope of survival. And even now, Mellis thought, the kid must have guessed that if he didn't throw the grenade, Mellis wasn't going to shoot. But he threw the grenade anyway, his lips curling back from his teeth. Fuck you, then, Mellis thought bitterly as the grenade sailed toward him. He pulled the trigger, and the M-16 responded on full automatic. The bullets ripped through the kid's chest and face, blowing the backs of his lungs and brain out. Mellis put his head down on top of his rifle and moaned. I told you not to throw it, you fucking asshole. The grenade exploded, scattering shrapnel all along Mellis's left side. He was still wearing two flak jackets, so only his buttocks and legs took the jagged metal. Jackson found him there, still lying on top of his rifle, a few seconds later.
You all right, Lieutenant?
Mellis nodded. He painfully rose to a half-crouch, using his rifle to push himself up. Marines were gathering beneath the lip of the landing zone. All that remained to be dealt with were a few isolated holes on top, where small groups of North Vietnamese had taken cover.
They're running! He heard someone shout. They're fucking running!
At last. His eye felt as if a nail were being hammered into it. His legs were burning. He limped up to the two dead North Vietnamese soldiers who had been throwing grenades at them. They looked about 15 or 16 years old. He poked one with his rifle, and there was a movement, a twitch. He pulled the trigger, forgetting that he still had his M-16 on automatic, and fired three bullets through the kid's head before he could stop. His rage was gone, and in its place was an inert, sick weariness. Mellis now knew, with utter certainty, that the North Vietnamese would never quit. They would continue the war until they were annihilated, and he did not have the will to do what that would require. He stood there, looking at the waste. Below the West Ridge, Hamilton's work was just beginning.
They're coming off the hill, he shouted. God damn it, hurry, let's go!
He and Mole emerged from the jungle onto the defoliated ridge. They threw themselves down, and the rest of the squad scrambled to join them. Hamilton was pointing excitedly at a small group of figures who were trotting in an orderly fashion off Matterhorn. Mole set the bipod of the gun down on the earth. His A-gunner crawled next to him, holding the long belt of bright copper bullets away from the feeder assembly. Mole began to fire. Two of the figures went down. The others scattered.
"We're getting some, Lieutenant,"
Hamilton said happily over the radio. He saw a small hillock just in front of them. He tapped Mole on the shoulder. It would be a perfect place to command the entire finger. He stood up and ran, the radio on his back. Mole started after him. A rocket-propelled grenade slashed violently out of the jungle where the NVA had taken cover. It exploded in front of Hamilton, killing him instantly. Mole shouted Hamilton's name. He tossed his gun to his A-gunner, grabbed Hamilton's body, and dragged it back to their original safe position. The rest of the squad followed him. Mole wasn't about to get his ass killed because some fucker went bloodthirsty on them. The fight for the LZ moved into its final phase. The south and east slopes were covered with Marines methodically killing anything that moved. Fitch and the CP group were walking up the south slope. Hawk and Connolly, who had captured the NVA machine gun, were covering the exposed northern slope, firing at the retreating enemy with careful, short bursts. Three groups of NVA, unable to escape, had set up positions in the old Gulf Battery artillery pits. One of the groups had a machine gun that was keeping the Marines at bay, covering the top of the hill with its fire. Mellis radioed Hawk. I'm sending a baseball team around to the north to get behind that fucking gun. You'll see character Charlie with a bandage on his head instead of a helmet. Don't shoot his ass. Over. Mellis looked up at Cortell, who was nodding, his filthy bandage unraveling slightly.
You tell him to pop some smoke when he gets there so we don't shoot him. Over.
Hawk returned.
Mellis relayed the message, and Cortell nodded again. Mellis pulled his last smoke grenade from his belt suspender and gave it to Cortell. There was a sudden explosion nearby. The three of them flinched. There was yelling in Spanish. Amarillo had thrown two grenades into a bunker just below them and was now crawling rapidly inside. There was a brief spatter of shots from his .45. Everyone waited anxiously, watching the entrance of the bunker. The familiar camouflage of the Marine Jungle Utility emerged, back first. Amarillo was pulling a shrapnel-mutilated body out of the bunker behind him. The shots had all been fired into the man's skull. Then a ricochet from the NVA machine gun spun crazily over their heads. "Okay, Cortell, get going," Mellis said. Cortell crawled off to join his squad. Mellis poked his head above the hole he and Jackson shared with the two dead North Vietnamese boys. He pulled one of the bodies down, stuffed it into the bottom of the hole, and stood on it to get a slightly better view. The LZ was deserted save for Robertson's body, which lay sprawled by the side of the blasted machine gun bunker. No trees remained on Matterhorn. The thick bushes that he and Scar had first tumbled into when they arrived were burned away. The entire beautiful hill was shorn, shamed, and empty. Mellis saw Goodwin poke his head briefly above the lip of the LZ. Goodwin ducked down again when machine gun and rifle fire from some nearby positions opened up on him. Goodwin radioed Mellis. "How are we going to get that fucker, Jack?" Mellis explained that Cortell was working his way behind the position. It would be a matter of time. The remaining enemy were trapped. Occasionally a Marine would pop up, apparently desultorily, unload half a magazine in the direction of the enemy machine gun and get back down. Mellis saw Cortell's red smoke. He stood up shouting, "Don't shoot! Cease firing! Cease firing!" Goodwin did the same. Cortell's bandaged head appeared momentarily above the crest. The seven kids left in the squad jumped above the lip of the LZ, threw seven grenades at the machine gun position, and jumped down out of sight. The gunner started to turn the barrel to meet the new threat. The grenades went off in and around the shallow pit, causing a series of shock waves that hammered Mellis's eardrums. Immediately, Goodwin was rushing across the LZ toward the smoke from the explosions. A stunned NVA soldier struggled to turn the machine gun on Goodwin, but couldn't move fast enough. Goodwin, like a panther making a kill, was on top of him, firing his M16. The remaining NVA in nearby gun pits stood up, weaponless, eyes filled with terror, and raised their hands. They were cut down in seconds as every available weapon on the hill turned on them. Mellis, still standing on the dead boy's body, slumped his head forward and rested his bloody, stinging face on the cool clay. Jackson leaned back, resting his radio against the side of the hole. "We won," Jackson said. Mellis simply nodded inside his helmet liner. His helmet was motionless against the clay. He reveled in the feel of the cool earth against his chin and mouth. Soon, however, the wind made his damp utility shirt too cool for comfort. He dragged himself from the hole and started shouting at various fire team leaders to organize the defense in case of a counterattack. Then he remembered Hamilton waiting in ambush down below.
Bravo 1-3, Bravo 1, sorry I rushed you in so much. Why don't you get up here and set in from 8 to 10? 12 is due north. Over."
There was a long pause.
1-3, this is 1 actual. Did you copy? Over."
Mole's voice came over the radio, trembling.
"Character Hotel is course. Over."
Mellis's hand started shaking.
"Any others? Over."
"We got 2 minor olies. Over."
"Can you get everyone in without help? Over."
"Yeah, over."
1 out. Mellis handed Jackson the handset. The hill was theirs. Jackson leaned over and put his head in his hands. Mellis limped to the edge of the LZ and watched Mole struggle up the hill with Hamilton slung over his back. Mole dumped Hamilton at Mellis's feet.
"Sorry, sir. I know you was tight."
He walked away, leaving Mellis standing over Hamilton's body. Mellis silently emptied Hamilton's pockets. he found a letter from Hamilton's mother. In it she'd written, "Don't you worry, Buster. You'll be home soon, and it will be all over." Mellis hadn't known Hamilton's nickname was Buster. He felt he had never known Hamilton at all, and never would know him. Mellis's left leg throbbed with the shrapnel, and his right leg burned. Blood caused his trousers to stick. He felt a sharp, pulsing pain in his blinded eye. If only he could sit down, just sit down and do nothing. But the defenses had to be set in. He struggled to his feet. An explosion slammed against him. He hit the dirt, rolling next to Jackson. They both looked up to see greasy smoke drifting across the LZ. Someone was shouting for a corpsman.
"Mine! A mine!" someone shouted from Goodwin's sector. "The place is fucking mined!"
"Jesus shit," Mellis muttered. He stood up again. The land around him had become toxic. He didn't know where to step. Still, the company had to be set in. Mellis went to his knees, crawling so he could see the signs of a buried mine or tripwire as he went from hole to hole. The kids, too, just wanted to sit. Mellis joked with them, cajoled them, threatened them. Eventually, they started to dig into the hill, throwing dead bodies from holes, redigging half-buried trenches. Others were struggling up the hill with dead Marines or helping to move the wounded so they could be evacuated. Fitch called for volunteers to clear a small section of the hilltop for a medevac bird. Soon a line of Marines formed and slowly crawled across the area with their K-bars in front of them, probing for mines, watching for tripwires. One kid was blown open from the abdomen when his knee set off a pressure device his knife had missed. They threw what remained of him onto the pile. Fitch called an actuals meeting. Mellis made his way around the rim of the LZ. Smoke choked and nauseated him. It drifted sluggishly from the hill to join the heavy gray clouds rolling endlessly away toward Laos. "Nice work, Mel," Fitch said. He was haggard and drawn. Hawk and Goodwin were both sitting with their elbows resting on the inside of their knees. They were staring into space. "Hamilton got killed," Mellis answered. "He used to carry my radio. He had no idea why he was talking. He just had to tell someone." "Is con man okay?" he asked Hawk. Hawk nodded. Fitch looked at Mellis more closely. "You need to be medevaced," he said. Mellis didn't answer. With his good eye, he was looking across at Helicopter Hill. He saw people with bright green uniforms looking at them through field glasses. "The fucking bastards cheered," Mellis said very softly. "Hey," Hawk said, touching Mellis's shoulder. "It's okay. They didn't know." Resnick walked over with the radio and gave Fitch the handset. "Big John 6, Skipper," he said. The colonel's voice was crisp, businesslike.
"Roger, Bravo 6, I want a full body count and after-action report. We have your medevac bird standing by. That zone of yours safe yet? Over."
"Not yet. Over," Fitch said flatly.
"Magnificent. I wish I'd had a movie camera, that's all I can say. Big John 6 out."
Fitch tossed the handset onto the ground next to Resnick. "He wishes he'd had a fucking movie camera," he said. He stared across the little dip toward Helicopter Hill. Mellis followed Fitch's gaze, his mind filled with tumbling images. The company too weary to go on, but going on. Watching helplessly as the bombs fell on the far side of the hill. The stupid cheering, as if combat were a Friday night football game. Simpson's incredible order on the long march to Skycap that there would be no more medevacs. Hippie. Crippled. The insane pushing, the stupidity, the blood pumping from the new machine gunner's leg. Jacobs's throat. For what? Where was the meaning? Mellis's good eye focused on the little figure in the clean jungle utilities. He saw only the colonel. The 600 meters separating them shrank to nothing. Mellis decided to kill him. He limped slowly away from the group.
"Hey, Jack!"
Goodwin shouted, but Fitch put a hand on his arm, holding him down. Hawk watched Mellis, a puzzled expression on his face. Mellis walked down the hill through Hawk's lines. He barely acknowledged the greetings of Conman and the 3rd Platoon as they dug in. Just beyond the lines, Mellis chambered around and put the rifle's selector on safety. He pushed into the brush, down onto the finger, moving closer to the other hill, not caring about the danger. He found a log and adjusted his sights for the distance, taking pleasure in the fact that he was doing just what he'd been taught on the rifle range. He settled in. The flat gray morning seemed eternal. Time was meaningless. There was only the small figure of the colonel, high above him now on the defoliated hillside. He pushed the selector to full automatic. With the tracers, Mellis was sure to get him. He leaned over the rifle, twisting his neck sideways so his good eye was sighting down the barrel. The colonel turned away from him. Mellis waited. He wanted the bastard to see the tracers coming at him before they ripped him apart, so he'd know, just as Jacobs had known. The colonel was still talking. Mellis waited as patiently as an animal. Time stopped. Only this one task. Wait for the bastard to turn around so he could see the bullets coming. Then Simpson started to turn. Mellis heard someone yell hoarsely behind him. Hawk landed on him in a headlong dive, forcing the rifle forward as Mellis jerked the trigger. The bullets tore the earth in front of them. Mellis, in a fury, reached out to hit Hawk. Hawk rolled away, kicking hard, knocking the rifle from Mellis's hands. Mellis swung his fist, hitting Hawk square in the face, and stood up to look for his rifle. Then Hawk was on his feet, standing in front of him, breathing hard, his rifle pointed just to Mellis's side, but obviously ready to defend himself. "God damn you, Hawk! God damn you to hell!" Hawk said nothing, watching Mellis, on his guard. Mellis began shrieking. "That bastard killed all of them! He sent us up here without air so he could watch a show! He watched us while we died! That bastard doesn't deserve to live! God damn you, Hawk! God damn you and your fucking... your... oh, God damn us all!" He sank to the ground and stared at nothing. Hawk put his hand on Mellis's shoulder. "Come on, Mel, the counterattack could hit us any minute." Mellis followed Hawk back up the hill.
Chapter 19. The counterattack never materialized. The NVA were heading to Laos, covering their retreat with well-placed infantry and mortar units. A medevac bird beat its way up the valley, and Palak talked it in. 3 NVA mortar rounds bracketed the chopper, sending the Marines who were dragging the wounded aboard to the ground. They immediately rose and got the wounded aboard, and then ran for their holes, holding their helmets against the rotor wash. The helicopter dived off the edge of the LZ and soared downward into space, picking up airspeed. Another bird made it in and took the last of the emergency cases. Then the fog returned. This stopped the shelling, but it also stopped any further medical evacuations. The day was spent in weary stupefaction, hauling dead American teenagers to a stack beside the landing zone, and dead Vietnamese teenagers to the garbage pit down the side of the north face. The senior squid told Fitch that Mellis's right eye was seriously injured. If the eye wasn't already lost, it would be without immediate surgery. The only place where that could happen was on one of the hospital ships. Mellis told Fitch that with Conman probably needing to take 3rd Platoon when Hawk went back to battalion staff, he didn't feel comfortable turning 1st Platoon over to either Jackson or Cortell. No matter how much combat experience they had, they were still only 19. Besides, Fitch and Goodwin would be the only officers in the company. In reality, although he didn't say it aloud, Mellis had simply grown too fond of everyone to leave the platoon facing danger without his help. He refused to go.
Fitch knew that Mellis was right about the lack of leaders, and as far as he could tell, the eye was already lost. So he let Mellis stay. That evening, Mellis and